Welcome back to another episode of the How To Fitness Podcast. I'm Kate Lyman.
And I'm Michael Yejeva.
And we've got a deep dive for you today. My favorite. Actually, my favorite because Michael's doing the deep dive, so I just get to show up.
Yeah, being the recipient of the deep dive is a lot more chill, a lot more laid back. So enjoy it, Kate.
It's the best place to be. We were just talking about how Jude's about to go to, you call it nursery, daycare, childcare.
Nursery. Yeah, we say nursery, but nursery. Yeah, I appreciate there's quite a few words that we use. But yeah, he starts, he's doing 3 days a week nursery. So we're about to enter the world of nursery / daycare drop-offs with my wife going back to work after her very fortunate 12 months off work with Jude. So yeah, it's going to be a bit of a change, but I'm excited.
Maybe you're going to be sick all the time. I don't know. I hear that's what happens.
Yeah, this is literally what everyone says to me. As soon as I mention that he's going to nursery, they're like, well, you're going to be ill all the time, which is exactly what I want to hear when I'm 2 months out of an Ironman 70.3 event. Thanks. So yeah, today we have another deep dive. So this is a cool topic that I thought would be quite fun to delve into. So the title is a little bit clickbaity because, hey, as we did on our Reel Together, Kate, we're a podcast and that's how things work around here. So do we really need to exercise? And today I just kind of wanted to explore the kind of the idea or belief of kind of like how much control we have over our own health, basically. I think if you were to believe the fitness industry, we have 100% control over our health. And I wanted to explore that and see, do we need to exercise? What is all the nuance around it? And it's a fun one. I think you'll like it.
I'm excited for this because there's a little bit of myth busting we also get to do, right? Like, how many steps do we need? How many minutes do we need? I don't know if that's what you're going to talk about, but I'm excited.
Exactly.
To hear.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. All of those things are in here. So it's fun. Like at the end, I just like threw in a few points that that probably didn't quite fit into the podcast format, but I wanted to talk about it. So if you're at the end and you're like, oh, this is left field, run with it. It's like, it's fine. I want to talk about
you're
it.
In charge.
So I'm in charge. So send an email to complain and I will not read it. Right. Are you ready to go, Kate?
I can't wait. Let's do it.
Also, I just want to say, like, Kate has been told she's supposed to wear glasses and she is not wearing glasses. And I'm upset about this, Kate, because were joking about before this episode, we're just starting to look like each other. More tattooed, wearing glasses.
They literally look like your glasses.
We got very similar glasses.
Oh, man.
They're good, though. They suit you. They look great.
Thanks.
No worries.
But you're right. I'm not going to wear them.
Okay. Just outside of podcast only. fine. Right. Should we go? Should we kick things off?
Let's do it.
Okay. So as I mentioned, today's episode, I wanted to discuss and explore kind of how much control we have over our own health. So first of all, let's just discuss the kind of title of this episode. I think we might change it by the time this goes live, but it's kind of like, do we really need to exercise? I don't really want to burst anyone's bubble here. The podcast title is, there's kind of a simple answer. We don't need to exercise, but the health benefits, they're pretty widely reported. And if you can exercise regularly, your health will thank you for it. So let's just kind of park that as the overriding message. We've all heard time and time again that regular exercise and a balanced diet are key to maintaining our health. Diet and exercise are also aspects of our lifestyle that we have direct / some level of control over. But how much do diet and exercise really matter compared to factors outside of our control? In the end, our health is determined by a combination of so many different factors, which we will explore in today's episode. But by how much? So first of all, let's address the kind of discussion point. So I'm going to list a few benefits of exercise. Once again, a lot of this will come as absolutely no surprise to our listeners, because, I mean, if you're tuning into a health and fitness podcast, you probably know that there's some health benefits to kind of concentrating on those things. But hey, we can all benefit from a little friendly reminder from time to time. So let's start with health factors that are in our control. So Kate, you probably know that exercise is important, but what are the actual physical benefits? So exercise is good for staving off chronic health conditions like heart disease, diabetes, and dementia. Additionally, regular exercise is great for maintaining strength and agility as a person ages. In a hunter-gatherer society, physical activity was built into the lifestyle. Hunter-gatherers participated in a mixture of moderate and vigorous physical activity every day. In contrast, our modern Western culture doesn't really promote this as often, and instead promotes a more sedentary way of life for many people. Many of us work desk jobs in an office and drive almost everywhere else. The modern lifestyle encourages behaviours that are less than favourable, and none of these behaviours align with the way that humans potentially have evolved over kind of millennia to depend on exercise for survival. And Kate, I thought this was quite a, we should probably discuss American culture here, because this, I feel like this is a bigger issue for you guys. I actually recently saw a reel on this topic where two guys from the UK went to America and thought they didn't have to hire a car and they could just walk everywhere and couldn't. So I'd also be interested to hear what's the difference between now that you live in Mexico compared to being in the US, like how things have changed there as well, or is it quite similar?
Well, so where we live in Oaxaca, and I specifically live in like a neighborhood that is walkable because I hate being in the car. I don't know how to tell you how much I hate being in a car. Like this is a lifelong thing. I do not like being in a car. I just am very upset about time in the car. Which is difficult, like when you live in the US and your whole life revolves around being in a car, right? But where we live here is so walkable. We do own a car, and because that was kind of like a Kenny purchase, something he wanted, I would say I've driven it maybe like 5 times in 3 years. And I prefer to walk everywhere, or I'll even like catch a taxi if I need a little something extra. But we were just back in the US last week, and I cannot tell you how much I missed walking. Like how desperate I felt to walk around and do things. And this is just so especially true with our jobs, which are so sedentary. It's funny to work in health and fitness and be so sedentary. Like I can easily spend 10 hours at my computer without moving, really, besides like going to the bathroom. So kind of like the forced walking, if I need to go do something, I got to walk to get there, is to me like really beneficial, but then also it's such a mood booster. Like I enjoy it and I love it. And so every time we're back in the US, I'm just kind of reminded that the infrastructure does not support that. And it makes it really hard for me to imagine moving back, honestly.
I mean, the fact that you hate cars or being in a car, you were never going to live in the US long term. It's funny, every time I speak to my clients, they'll be like, oh, I'm just going to go visit my family. They live really close. It's only like an 8-hour drive away. And I'm like, this is like the length of the UK.
Yeah, I'm just going to say, how far can you get in 8 hours?
I mean, I can drive from, we live pretty much bang on 8 hours from our family, and that's considered like really, really far away. Yeah. And people think you're slightly insane for driving it. But yeah, the fact that a lot of people in the US are like, oh, that's easy, that's pretty close, is wild to me.
To be fair, I would never say that. I would say fly me there or I'm not going to see my family.
Yeah. So, okay. Well, so another cool thing I wanted to focus on in this episode is kind of like, what is the minimal effective dose? And I'll explain that kind of in a second. So if exercise is important, but not built into our lifestyles, how do we make time for it? And I know, Kate, you're kind of as busy as I am. Actually, I'd probably say you're busier than I am, because I feel like we both got really busy workloads, but then you've got like a team of people you have to manage too. So maybe your schedule's a little bit more bonkers than mine, but it's really hard to schedule in physical activity when you are so busy. Like you mentioned there, you could sit at your desk for like 10 hours without moving. I could do exactly the same, hence why I got a walking pad, which feels very, every time I get on it, it feels like Wall-E, you know, when like the humans on that spaceship and no one's moving around. That's what it always reminds me of. Something a bit wrong about it, but it works. So it seems like most people don't have an extra hour each day to spend at the gym. There was a really cool study in 2015, which we will link in the show notes below, that looked into the minimal effective dose when it comes to exercise. So what is the least amount of exercise you can do to still see some positive health outcomes? And I also, reminds me, Kate, I want to talk about this point kind of at the end of this little section. And because I think there's kind of a good discussion about how the fitness industry kind of demonizes this approach and it's seen as a bad thing, whereas in fact, I actually think it can be something really handy for a lot of people to focus on. So this research actually showed that 15 minutes a day of moderate intensity exercise or 8 minutes a day of high intensity exercise is enough to reduce the risk of death compared to a sedentary lifestyle. A short jog or at-home workout can offer the substantial health benefits that you need. What was also really cool about this study was every additional 15 minutes of moderate intensity exercise, there was a further 4% reduction in the risk of death as well.
That is so cool.
It's so cool. It's huge as well. Yeah, I loved that stat as well. So making time for even... Sorry, go for it. Go for it.
Do you know what is 8 minutes long or is it 4 minutes? A Tabata. Two Tabatas is 8 minutes, right?
Yeah.
Am I getting my math right? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Like it's really short and it has such a huge impact. So I kind of feel like I've been wasting my time the last few months doing really long swim cycles and runs. I need to cut this down.
No, think about that 4%. You're like defying death at this point.
Interesting point. We will come back to that in a second. So,
because it's got to be a bell curve.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So making
an ultra runner for a while.
Yeah. There's definitely like a peak. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So making time for even a bit of exercise can be really helpful in extending your healthy lifespan. And this is a really important point I want listeners to take on board. So kind of despite what you see on social media, you don't have to be a marathon runner or a hardcore triathlete to achieve health benefits from moving your body. Even small amounts of exercise and modest increases in fitness can make a clear difference. And some exercise is always better than no exercise. So yeah, I just always, when I was doing the research for this and typing this out, I did feel like how kind of disenchanted or how kind of separate the fitness industry actually feels from the findings of this research paper, where we're kind of told that workouts have to be like really long and sweaty and hard for them to be beneficial. There's a big push recently of kind of cozy cardio. I did a post on this a few months back that was getting a lot of stick from a lot of usually oiled up topless personal trainers that thought that people were just being lazy, where in fact, like really small, moderate types of exercise can just be incredibly beneficial. And yeah, I thought we should just take a minute to criticize the fitness industry on this one, Kate.
Well, I love what you shared because here's the thing. I feel like when it comes to improvements or progress in health, nutrition, fitness, all of that, basically behaviors that are supportive to our health, are like what we're up against most is the all or nothing mentality, right? And like we can know intuitively that it doesn't make sense to say, well, I'll do an hour long sweaty workout or nothing. But it's really hard to fight that idea that it has to be like, quote, worth it. But hearing those numbers, the 15 minutes or the 8 minutes, like the hard data on this is the minimal effective dose, that feels really impactful to me. And maybe that's just like how my brain works. But like, I want to know a number. I want to know really what do I need? You know what I mean? Yeah.
I'm the same. As soon as all the numbers written down, I'm like, oh, okay, this feels more achievable. So I really hope that those listening feel the same way, that it doesn't have to be this kind of big, brutal run where you're training for a marathon and that's the only thing that's kind of going to help you to improve health markers. 15 minutes or like an 8 minute, brutal, like tougher, high intensity workout. Yeah. Like it's really short. It's awesome.
But it's almost like even permission that you don't have to like change all your clothes, get a post or a pre-workout meal in, take some pre-workout, you know, like go to the gym and then come back. Cause sometimes like that travel time is the most time intensive, you know?
Right.
It's like you could do what I said, a Tabata of some body weight stuff, like right there in your office or, you know, like the exercise snacks people talk about. And I just feel like it's really awesome permission. And even I need to hear that too, because like I can't train the way I want right now. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes I'm like, why? I hate this. You know, like I'm doing more like rehab type movement and it's so boring, like physical therapy type exercises, but it is worth it. It is worth it. And that was a reminder needed.
Like it. I'm glad you found it helpful as well, Kate. So then if you can experience benefits within 15 minutes, kind of the point you're touching on, is more exercise always better? So not exactly. So this point really interested me as I mentioned, I'm kind of deep in Ironman training at the moment. And it turns out that there is a maximum amount of exercise that is good for the human body. Of course, this is just findings from one study. There are lots of others that look into this, but it's kind of cool to touch upon where, especially when the fitness industry always glamorizes like more equals better. Usually it isn't. So one study out of Missouri Medicine looked at whether really strenuous endurance exercise was beneficial for people middle-aged and older. They found that in older individuals, strenuous exercise actually puts the heart at risk. In contrast, low and moderate doses of physical activity were shown to significantly reduce cardiovascular mortality. The paper deemed this moderate amount of activity to be the Goldilocks zone, which I really liked. That's quite cool. In which physical activity is beneficial and not harmful. The recommendation in this zone is 150 minutes per week of moderate intensity aerobic exercise or 75 minutes of intense activity.
Oh, wow. I mean, that makes sense to me. And it also is probably super individualized to like what your capacity is or what your training history is like. But I understand that you wouldn't want to pick up on high intensity, long endurance training after not having a history of doing that, you know, like exactly. later in middle age. That makes sense to me.
Exactly. And so also too much vigorous activity can cause cardiac overuse injury and cardiovascular damage at any age. So this is similar to the type of overuse injuries you see in athletes, such as stress fractures, tendonitis, and shin splints. So in short, the heart is a muscle and that muscle can be damaged. Strenuous exercise also produces free radicals, which can then damage tissues. And these findings are all in line with the idea that humans evolved to be like hunter-gatherers, maybe where this lifestyle would require light to moderate activity throughout the day with short bursts of vigorous exercise. It seems as though both sedentary and extremely active people would maybe benefit from a slightly more moderate amount of exercise to focus on.
Imagine that. Moderate.
I know, balance, right? How boring. Give me the Iron Man, Kate. Yeah. So I want to actually have now a bit of a throwback to an episode that you did, Kate. We actually spoke about this article on iMessage, actually, not publicly. I'm just going to jump into it. You'll know what I'm talking about, Kate. I'm going to let you actually describe it when we get in. So it sounds like if you exercise a moderate amount, will you live a longer and healthier life, right? It probably won't shock you that, unfortunately, this is not the case. As we know, even the best laid plans cannot guarantee you anything in life. External factors like disease, stress, and genetics all play a huge role in the way that your health develops. In fact, not even money can assure you a healthy life. So Kate, you spoke about this guy on an episode a few weeks back. If you want to kind of give a quick snappy rundown of who Brian Johnson is and how he's been spending his money, that would be great.
Oh yeah, you scared me at first. I was like, oh no, this is like a quiz and I just don't know if I remember what we talked about. But yeah, absolutely. Brian Johnson, billionaire who has spent a lot of his money ensuring that he's like creating, what did he call it? An algorithm to live forever, I think is what kind of what he poses this as. But he takes like 100 supplements a day. He does things like penis shockwave therapy that you and I could not get over. And, you know, hyperbaric chamber, all the things.
And Brocomax as well. Don't forget
and
the Brocomax.
He takes his Brocomax. I think like blood transfusions, all of these things to attempt to live forever. And then I believe he has long COVID, which is really sad because I cannot imagine how devastating it would be to like feel like your whole life has been towards this. Like, you know, with this mission of living forever and or prolonging life. I don't think he actually thinks he can live forever, but and then to be derailed by something that you can't control, you know, I think that's where you're going with this. And it is very sad. And someone told me that he was on Trevor Noah's podcast and it was really interesting. So I still need to listen to that.
There we go.
My to-do list.
I will listen to that as well. And yeah, you absolutely nailed it. So Brian Johnson is a tech billionaire who has been on a quest for immortality. I mean, that's what it's quoted as. I'm sure he knows that he's not going to live forever, but he's trying to extend that for as long as possible. And he was undergoing lots of experimental treatments to prevent aging. But in a tweet on February the 10th, 2024, so very recently, he admitted that a mild COVID infection cost him 15% of his lung function that no treatment has been able to restore. And I will touch on the kind of socioeconomic factors a little bit later in the episode. But I did feel that this story was really important to briefly mention that it just goes to show that even a billionaire that has access to all of the money, all of the professional support the world has to offer, can't escape a pandemic or control every single external factor that impacts our health. It does kind of show that we are not in complete control, despite what a lot of people will have you believe, especially in trying to get your money from you in trying to achieve it. Yeah,
that's devastating. 15% lung capacity is like devastating. That's really impactful, especially I assume he knows every stat on his body. You know, I'm sure he knows everything about how he functions optimally, and to like, even that's almost sounds like a burden of knowledge to know how much you've been impacted negatively by a sickness.
Yeah, it's really awful. And it's the interesting thing is that apparently this, according to the article that I read online, I'll link it below as well. I don't want to feel like I'm spreading nonsense. But the article did say that he admitted to this on that date with the tweet. However, he said that it happened quite a long time ago. And he's done lots of interviews since then talking about how he's looking to kind of the chase of immortality. But he'd never ever mentioned that he was having issues with COVID or long COVID. And it's slightly bizarre that he wouldn't mention that in all of the interviews he's done in terms of prolonging his health. I thought that was just an important little bit to snip onto the side there. But yeah, really crap. I've worked with many clients now who have long-term health issues now as a result of suffering COVID at some point over the last 3-4 years. And it's brutal. So I don't want this to be like a got your moment. It's shit, let's be honest. But I just thought it was important to prove that, or to show that we don't have full control there, even if you've got everything at your disposal.
Maybe we'll talk about this soon, but something that I guess this is kind of like the culmination of this episode, something I talk about so consistently with my clients is let's control the controllables. Like, we have things that we can do to support our health, to support our nutrition, to make the best food choices that align with our goals, or make the best movement choices that align with our goals. But we can't control what we can't control. And worrying about it is such a waste of our time. You know, it just is like draining mentally and physically. And all we can do is control our controllables. And he's a very, very dramatic version of that, right? Because he has like this whole like quest for immortality at his disposal. But it applies to us too. And that's kind of what you're talking about with the minimal effective dose with exercise and, you know, doing what we can do, which is always easier said than done.
Completely. Yeah, I hope that the messaging I'm getting across from this episode, people will go away from it kind of feeling like a bit more in control of, or maybe more at ease in the fact that we don't have complete control, rather than kind of being told we should be doing this and that and that and that. And if you don't, oh my God, your health's really going to suffer. So I hope that this episode will be reassuring. You don't come away thinking, damn, I wish I didn't listen to that guy. That was awful. So yeah, fingers crossed. Moan at Kate, not me, if that happens. Right. So another common belief is that exercise alone can give you a certain physical aesthetic. And I thought this was should be quite a good one to talk about, seeing as well, I know I especially get a lot of hate on social media from people that tell me that I shouldn't be preaching body neutrality to the fitness world. So fitness influencers love to sell us the idea that working out more and eating a specific diet will give you a body just like theirs, when in reality, genetics plays a major role in the way that your body looks at baseline and the way it responds to exercise too. Some people are naturally able to put on muscle very easily. Some people will also have a higher body fat percentage, even if they are under the exact same exercise and diet regimen. The heritability of BMI is huge, and using data analyzing the results of twin studies, it is estimated that the heritability of BMI, which is the proportion of total BMI variation explained by our genetics, can vary between 57% and 90% in adult populations. So yes, we can alter this through behaviors like exercise and calorie balance, but it means that genetics can explain a lot of your baseline body type too. And I think that that will be kind of quite comforting to a lot of people who are told that they're being lazy or it's all on them, the way that their body looks, when in reality, looking at the data, it absolutely isn't. It is not a level playing field. And that's what I wanted to highlight from this.
I want to tell a quick story. I have done like one cut in my life, like a big push towards aesthetic goals. I've done like little ones in the past, but like one time where I was like, really, this is what I'm doing, you know, I'm gonna get as lean as I can get. It was before my wedding. This is 2014, 2015. And I did get very lean. And I know people there's a lot of opinions around this, but I had a good time. I enjoyed it. It was sustainable for me for the most part. I mean, not all of it, but anyway, I was getting very lean. And I sent to my coach at the time a picture of this girl and her abs. And I was like, these are the abs I want. And that's funny because I would never do that now. But, you know, this is, we're talking 10 years ago. And And I was very lean. I had like a defined musculature at the time. And my coach said, well, you will never get that because like literally your muscles are different. Like the way that your abdominal muscles show are not like this person. This was not like a fitness model. This is just a person I literally found online. Like, I don't know where I saw her. She wasn't like it wasn't a famous person. I just saw this girl in like a workout video and I was like, ooh, I like what she has. You know what I mean? And my coach like broke me down so quickly. She was like, too bad. Like, that's not
possible. I like that your coach did that because a lot of coaches would not have done that. That's awesome.
No, she's great. She was great. And she said, like, your physiology is different. Like, we can get you really lean and you can have visible abs and you kind of do already, but they're never going to look like that because, like, see how her six pack is built? It's different. So just, you should stop thinking about that right now. And she kind of like brought me back to earth. It was a good experience for me. It really was.
I like that. I did something similar as well. I remember I think I might have had it as the background on my phone at one point when I was kind of deep in the bodybuilding world.
Oh, that makes me so happy.
Yeah.
How we've
it's
grown.
Really cringe. We have grown well, Kate. And he was an ex-Premier League or ex-professional football player, soccer player, turned WWE wrestler. If anyone knows wrestling or football, they'll probably know who that guy is. I can't remember his name, but he was jacked. And I thought, like, that's what I'm going to look like. I'm going to work really hard, lift weights, be really on it with my nutrition. Looking back now, the guy was clearly taking steroids. Like, I was never, ever going to look anything like this guy. But yeah, I kind of fell for this too. And I thought, right, if I work hard enough, if I restrict myself to get lean enough, if I'm really rigid and regimented with my strength training, I can get there. Where in reality, it was never going to happen and never has since 10, 12 years down the line. So don't worry, Kate, I'm with you there.
And you're not on steroids is what you're saying.
Yeah, I'm clear. Yeah, I'm not on steroids.
Okay, just checking.
Yeah. Breaking news. Yeah.
For me, it was a really positive experience. It didn't rock my world or anything, but it just made me think, oh, okay, well then I'll just focus on my abs, which, you know, we're talking about within context of like, I was doing this. This is my goal short term, yada, yada. Like, this is not a forever thing. But to me, it was very enlightening. And it was what we're talking about. Like, genetics are different. The same person with the same weight, height, sex, age could be doing the same protocol as you. And everything's going to be different because we're individuals. And that's a great thing.
Yeah, I followed the training plan in that Men's Health magazine and the meal plan that he posted as well, and it didn't happen. So I was my own case study then, sadly. So also one really cool paper also analyzed 3,000 adults between aged 18 and 55. These adults had never participated in exercise training at all. The participants underwent an exercise regimen for at least 2 weeks without any diet changes. The paper found that an astonishing 72% of the muscle strength changes could be explained by genetics, which I thought was really cool. Cardiovascular fitness was less affected by genetics at an estimated 44%. These findings show that genetics plays a huge role in the way that your body responds to exercise. And it also suggests that genetic analyzing, potentially down the line, could be used to tailor fitness programs a bit more effectively. But I feel like that's another complete podcast episode. I don't think the science is quite there yet, but yeah, that was huge. Like 72% of muscle strength changes from genetics and then 44% in terms of cardiovascular fitness too. That's wild to me.
That is massive. And I think we can swing too hard where we say, oh, I'm stuck in, you know, whatever body I'm in because it's genetics and I have no control, but that's not what you're saying here. You're saying this is a factor that is relevant. And we can control our controllables. I think that it's all how we perceive a message, right? But I've definitely had clients who have felt like, you know, I'm working with you and I'm doing my best job, but because of genetics, nothing will ever happen. And it's not true. We're just working in our own lane, you know? You can't look like football or WWE wrestler, and I can't look like that random girl I found because our genetics are different. But we still have change, progress, habits, et cetera, all of that in our control.
Yeah. And I wonder how I would have taken that news back then when I first found the image. But speaking as someone who is now hopefully more mature and is a bit older, it actually just brings me so much peace, right? I know that my body will respond to exercise completely different to someone else who probably will wants to become a men's health physique cover model, right? They're genetically likely going to put on muscle faster than me. Like, it doesn't annoy me. I'm just like, right, this is kind of what I'm working with, and it allows me to adapt things to suit my body and its needs. And I think that's really empowering.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. And we're not even just talking aesthetics, but like your capability as far as your fitness goes. Like, maybe you want to be competitive in something, and genetics play a role in how fit we can be, or how fast we can be, or how strong we can be. But then that kind of gives you that permission to like stay in your own lane, just do what you can do. And that's cool, I think.
I think it's really cool as well. And I hope that listeners will feel exactly the same way. Right, let's touch on socioeconomic influence now. So along with disease and genetics, socioeconomic status has a massive influence on health. According to the CDC, there are several socioeconomic factors that can directly impact your health status. These include education level, employment status, income, food security, and housing security. To start, higher education is associated with a lower likelihood of developing cardiovascular diseases. Getting a college degree can widen employment options and income down the line. It makes sense that more employment opportunities means more access to health insurance. Health insurance allows you to seek preventative and acute care, thus improving health outcomes. Individuals with incomes below the poverty level have higher rates of illness and premature mortality. Low incomes are associated with poor working conditions, lack of access to healthcare, and housing security too. It is estimated that in the US, men with incomes in the top 1% are expected to live a full 14.6 years longer than their counterparts in the bottom 1%. And that is a insane gap. So if you think about it, that's a man in the top 1% is expected to live a full decade and a half longer than someone in the bottom 1%. This says a lot about the healthcare system in the US. I appreciate that I don't live in the US, and money seems to have a huge influence on healthcare access reasons. The divide in the UK is there too. It's not as wide due to our kind of arguably better access to healthcare, even though the Conservative government are trying really damn hard to make that gap even wider. But yeah, I know that most of our listeners are from the US, so that's why I kind of pinpointed that. But that is wild. Like, a decade and a half longer simply due to income is pretty sad and terrifying.
It absolutely is. And it does not surprise me. Like, both of those are true in my mind, because I know how deep the disparity is, or how large that gap is in access, in health, in living conditions. As you were talking about this, I'm curious, I bet Mexico's even higher in terms of
really?
Gap. I would think so, because the difference between that 1% and top and bottom 1% feels even more, I don't know, like a bigger gap. I don't know that. I'm going to look it up and see if I can find that. A lot of times when I look up statistics here, I can't find them. So there's that.
That's true. It's difficult. I struggle to find the gaps within the UK too. There are quite big, I don't want to kind of give exact numbers because I'm going to butcher the numbers from when I was looking at it, but there is a big divide kind of between different areas of the UK that if we're looking kind of stereotypically, they have the higher paid jobs and lower paid jobs areas. And also Scotland doesn't fare too favorably on these lists as well within the UK. You obviously have the kind of wealthier parts of Scotland, parts of Glasgow, Edinburgh, for example, but there's lots of areas around that are quite money poor. And then with that comes worse health outcomes, unfortunately. So at lower income brackets, food insecurity can force families to trade off between nutritious food and affordable food. In the long term, unhealthy diets and stress about food can increase the risk of chronic diseases. Similarly, housing insecurity can expose people to chronic stress and choosing between housing, food, and medicine. But this very quick snapshot shows that socioeconomic factors combine to have a massive impact on health that exercise alone cannot fully control. There is no evidence that people in different income brackets vary greatly in the amount of daily exercise that they get. That being said, children in lower socioeconomic classes are often in a higher body weight bracket, which goes to show that physical activity alone is not a sufficient measure in kind of health markers. So this is where I mentioned at the start that I went a little bit off track. So it's just little things I wanted to talk about. This is that point. So roll with me here. So speaking of ways to track our activity, Kate, have you heard your family or friends talk about wanting to hit their 10,000 steps a day?
Oh, yeah. I fall in the bracket.
I am too. No, I'm exposed too. I quite like the benchmark just because it gives me a nudge to get moving, right? I know that that is arguably problematic, randomly focusing on a number that everyone is aiming for, but it kind of helps me get active. I like it.
I do too. And it's like the little nudge I need to move. It, you know, it's what we went back to. Like, I can sit here all day on my computer and not move. I don't want to, but I have enough stuff to get done that I can do that. And so it's the nudge I need to go on a little walk or go run an errand that I need to walk to and back, you know.
Yeah, it's true. And it's often touted, isn't it, as like the way to improve your health. It's pretty common goal, especially with how popular Fitbits, Apple Watches, Garmins, whatever, all are at the moment. And I was wondering if there was any scientific backing to the idea of 10,000 steps a day. I don't know if you know where it came from.
My understanding is it's kind of an arbitrary number made up by maybe like one of the fitness watches or something, but that the actual number we need is almost half of that, like a 6,000 step goal for the health repercussions.
Pretty close. So it turns out that the concept of 10,000 steps a day originated from a Japanese company that made a pedometer called, I'm sorry if I butcher the pronunciation of this, Manoike, which translates to 10,000 steps meter. The translation was weird in all the articles that I was reading, but I think it translates to like 10,000 steps recording device or something like that. And it was launched in line with the 1964 Tokyo Olympics. This 10,000 step goal was part of the branding for the pedometer because apparently the Japanese character for 10,000 resembles a person walking, and the idea kind of caught on. And I did search it, and it kind of does. So that's why they went for this kind of nice round number of 10,000 steps. And the marketing was pretty successful, as the 10,000 step goal sticks around to this day. However, yeah, I know, it's wild how it's like just from that marketing campaign since 1964.
You said in the 60s? Yeah, the 60s.
64. We're talking about Tokyo Olympics, 64.
60 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. Wow. So it seems that there isn't really anything special about hitting exactly 10,000 steps. In fact, in terms of mortality, there is a diminishing return after 7,500 steps. So getting between 4,400 and 7,500 steps per day was shown to reduce mortality by 41%, according to one Harvard study. After 7,500 steps, increasing your steps per day did not appear to affect mortality. It seems as though 10,000 steps is not necessarily the gold standard, although if it helps you get motivated to exercise, then is it a bad thing? Arguably not. So yeah, I thought that was quite cool.
I like a step goal, but I don't think it has to be 10,000. Like, I've had times where I've set my step goal, I do use a Fitbit, I love my Fitbit, to 12,000. I've had times where I've set it to 8,000. And to me, it's just like the goal of getting movement is the end goal. I do know that 10,000 is an arbitrary number, but I like that number. And the story behind it is kind of charming.
Yeah, I kind of like it as well. Like, yeah, it? I quite like it. You're going to have to, everyone's going to be, anyone on their phone now listening to this, just bring it up, go on Google and type in like English to Japanese translation, just type in 10,000, and it kind of does look like a little person.
I do that right,
it's
after quite this. Nice.
Yeah, it is quite nice. So yeah, I'm the same. Like, so for example, right now I'm doing a lot of cardio because I'm 2 months out of this race. So I don't need to worry about hitting my steps as closely because I'm always quite tired. So I drop that to like 6,000-7,000 as like my goal if I've not done anything. Whereas if I go through periods where I'm not doing as many training sessions, I'll like ramp up the step goal just to force me to get a bit more movement in. But I don't know, I quite like knowing that 7,500 is kind of like the bit that we should maybe be aiming for. After that, meh. Yeah. I quite like it. Yeah,
I agree. I have clients who I work with on 5,000 step goal, and the intention isn't the number. It's let's get you moving a little bit more. Yeah. And maybe once you hit 5,000 consistently, let's push it to 6,000, because we're working on making movement a facet of your life. It's not about the numbers, but you know, often we get caught up in the wrong thing, and the intention is move a little more, not what number of steps are you hitting? Plus, so like true. All this step talk assumes that everyone has a watch. I know that's not true, but the phones count steps too. Like, it's just the intention, right?
Or even go old school. Go on Amazon and buy a pedometer like the Manoike. And I don't know if they still make them. Maybe they do.
I would hope they do.
Yeah, I hope so. I will be searching this on Amazon after we're done. Cool. So the one other point I want to touch on. Kate, did you know that you probably did know this, but I'm just going to quiz you, pretend that you don't. Did you know that something as simple as grip strength could indicate a lot about your overall health? This is one of my favorite pieces of research, and it's one that I quote quite often to clients, family members, just to kind of encourage people to think about strength training, because the health benefits are huge. So grip strength is an example of a biomarker or a sign that correlates strongly with medical status. Grip strength is largely consistent as an indicator for overall strength, upper limb function, bone mineral density, fractures, falls, malnutrition, cognitive impairment, depression, sleep problems, diabetes, multimorbidity, and quality of life. So many different things, the indicator can be grip strength. And this association was found in several countries and regions across the world. Having good grip strength depends on your muscle mass, which can only be maintained through sufficient diet and exercising habits. Some scientists think that it may be a more accurate indicator of life expectancy than blood pressure.
So I do remember this fact, because when I was in college, I was in my undergrad in exercise physiology class, we learned this. And I remember being like, no, that doesn't make sense. Like, not really. I mean, obviously I learned this fact and there was like research to back it up. I remember being like, that is wild.
Mm-hmm.
That, I mean, it really sounds far-fetched, but then it makes sense the mm-hmm. way you explained it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Grip it's strength. Really cool. Yeah. So I know that we're kind of looking at so many different aspects of health and longevity here, but one of the overriding messages from this is, I'd say anyone listening who doesn't do any strength training or hasn't considered doing strength training yet, I strongly encourage it, because if you can improve your grip strength through doing it, I mean, just the amount of things that you could potentially improve or reduce your risk of getting is massive. So yeah, it's one that I like to quote quite a lot.
Right. That was a long list of benefits.
It was a long list. Yeah, I think the list was longer. I didn't want to name all of them because I felt like the episode might go on quite a while. Honestly, it correlates with a lot of things. So get lifting, folks. Okay, right. So this is where if you feel like you've gotten this far and you still don't have time to exercise or incorporate exercise into your life, we do have some tips on improving your health without exercise. So this is the boring bit of the episode where Kate and I are going to put on our like really boring, unsexy coaching hats. That I feel like the end of every episode is just us being like, drink water, guys. Just like move your body. It's what you really need to do. Please. and that's exactly what this section is going to be. So I already have my boring hat on. I have it on at all times. So Kate, if you can put yours on too, that would be awesome. Thank you. For those listening without visual, Kate did just put on her fake hat. So the first one, stay hydrated. I'm not going to go into all the reasons why you should be doing these, because a lot of them are quite obvious, but staying hydrated can massively improve health markers in terms of cognition, energy levels, sleep, digestive health, all these things. So drink more water. Picking up the pace, kind of walking more than getting the car. So take Kate's lead, hate the car, and start walking a bit more and your health will improve. But don't go over 7,500 steps, because it's a waste of time. Eat a balanced diet for many obvious reasons. This will help. Take the stairs, get better sleep as well. Aim for 7 to 9 hours of sleep every night. I wish at the moment, but aim for 7 to 9 hours of sleep every night. Manage stress levels too, really, really important. And then one that also wanted to tag on the end, mostly because we went and just got ours done for due today, is be smart about getting vaccinations as well. That's important too. Those are the points I wanted to kind of close the show out on.
The hate you'll get from that one. Just gear up. Except you said don't send us hate mail. My email is the one on our show notes. And so I get the emails. It's not even fair. Just kidding.
Sorry, Kate.
but in addition to everything you said, I think also the point is you can move for 15 minutes. You can mm-hmm. move for 8 minutes. The bar is so much lower than we think, right? The bar is so much lower than we think. You don't need a full hour. And it's hard I think it's exceptionally hard if you've had that hour before and if you've loved that hour. Do you know what I mean? And you probably know this too, maybe not right now in this current season of training for the tri, but like with Jude and with life changing and kind of picking up pace, pre-kid, you had, I'm sure, an hour plus to get your lifting in. And it was unrushed and felt good. And then now time is more limited and it's hard to be okay with 30 minutes, even if you know even if you know it's better than nothing. But this shows you that 30 minutes is double that minimum of what you need, you know?
Yeah. Or nearly four times the amount you need, if I've done my maths correctly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And that is impactful, and that is a controllable we can control. It's just not maybe what you used to have or what is the ideal, but it still matters.
It's very true. I have had many clients come to me. I've written them up exercise plans, and they're like, oh, is that enough? I'm not finishing my workouts feeling like I'm going to die, or I'm incredibly sweaty or really out of breath. Like, you don't have to smash yourself into the ground to make progress. And hopefully all these stats and stuff that I've given you from this episode can prove that to you, that we can be a bit kinder to ourselves and enjoy the process a bit more, because you can make huge gains in such a short space of time.
Yeah, in all the ways, right? Like in the muscular strength and in all of the benefits, physical, cognitive, et cetera, that follow. And that matters. It does. Mm-hmm. I think health is a lower barrier in some ways, obviously, right? We're not talking about the kind of like external factors, but in some ways it's a lower barrier than we often think.
Agreed. I hope you enjoyed that, Kate. That was a fun one. I enjoyed researching that episode.
I did. I loved that. Thank you. I learned some things.
Good. Success. Tick. Awesome. Well, yeah, if anyone has any questions, if you want us to kind of explain anything further that we've mentioned within this show, then please let me know. As I said, I'll link to all the research papers that I did talk about in the show notes below. And yeah, let us know any other topics you want us to cover, anything me and Kate can help you with, reach out, and we would love to.
See you next time.
Bye.